morning again, all. The case we're arguing next is the United States v. Simpson. Mr. Inman.
May it please the court, counsel, and defense colleagues. I am Arthur Inman of Peoria for defendant appellant Levent Simpson. Also arguing this morning on the appellant's side will be Kim Kelly for co-defendant Jerry McGinnis and Spencer Daniels for co-defendant Sammy Simpson. I will argue principally point one of the brief, and Mr. Kelly will have point two of the brief, although he will argue third among us, and Mr. Daniels will have the remaining points of the brief and will appear second, if that's agreeable with the court.
It is.
The issue that I will approach with the court is, in its most general sense, the role that the trial judge should play in the trial of a criminal case in the federal court. At the outset, we concede that the trial judge does have broad responsibility to move the trial along, to keep it proceeding in an orderly fashion, and further has the responsibility to keep the trial focused on appropriate issues in terms of materiality, relevancy, and also to prevent abuse of witnesses. But, at least in American practice, the judge does not normally intervene in the trial in such a way as to reveal his own opinion as to how an issue should turn out or what the ultimate result of a trial should be. A trial judge in American practice normally does not try to betray to the triers of fact any notion of which side he favors or on a particular issue how that issue should turn out or how it should be decided by the jury.
Mr. Emmer, you question that it was 4-2 that you interrupted on the issue of commenting on reasonable doubt?
No.
Why was there a second time? I mean, why didn't...
No, I didn't indicate that I was interrupted 4 times. Mm-hmm. What was asserted in the briefs was, and by the judge himself, was that I had misspoken and misstated 4 separate times before the judge commented the first time. I note that the judge's comment for the first time came in the 29th minute of my 30-minute closing argument. And in that comment, he asserted that I had misstated the burden of proof on 4 separate occasions throughout that argument. And as you will recall from my brief, I suggested that if it was a misstatement, it occurred 5 times rather than 4 times. However, when I made that point, and I reiterate it now, I do not concede that in the context of the argument and of the entire case that there was a misstatement of the law. In the context of the case, to speak first to the point as to the propriety of the argument and therefore the impropriety of the denunciation of counsel, in Levent Simpson, I contended, was in a slightly different posture before the jury on the evidence than the 2 co-defendants. First, Levent Simpson was not present at the time of the death of the individual, and there is, of course, an attempt to isolate Levent Simpson from responsibility for that death, which, of course, has a higher penalty of life imprisonment. And secondly, there were phone records that were introduced concerning the other 2 defendants, and there were various statements of police officers which principally focused on the other two defendants, which, and there were no phone records as to LaVent Simpson. There was really no other evidence than the statements of the witnesses that Simpson was in, that LaVent Simpson, that is, was involved in the conspiracy. Therefore, I was attempting to suggest to the jury that the case did depend on the confidential sources, the turncoat witnesses, rather than on any independent evidence that could corroborate them. However, the judge's comment was to the effect that I had specifically misstated the evidence and was attempting to mislead the jury. And our position is such a denunciation of counsel before the jury would be devastating and was devastating to any defense that counsel could mount in behalf of his client. Now, if indeed my argument were improper, and I noted in the brief that the government either did not think the argument improper because they did not object, or that they thought they could handle it themselves, as they suggested in a filing in the trial court in response to the post-trial motion which we filed. They said, well, we were going to say something in rebuttal. Now, that is irrelevant, of course, to the point that we are making of the appearance before the jury, of the judge's conduct before the jury. But it does, to this extent, support the appellant's position in that the government did not see fit to object because they thought they had an adequate remedy for any misstatements by making a point in rebuttal.
Well, they don't bear the responsibility of the trial judge, though, do they?
They don't bear the responsibility of the trial judge.
Make a misstatement to what? They may either be asleep at the switches, Mr. Inman, or make a strategic decision that the jury might be troubled by their interrupting or making an objection. The judge has a standalone responsibility as to if he or she believes there's a misstatement that occurred. I'm not suggesting that I've concluded that. I'm just suggesting there's a different role, and we can't draw too much from the silence of the government.
Well, I suppose the government does have a different responsibility than the judge,
and a different perspective.
I think the government is entitled in that connection to make their tactical and strategic decisions as to how they prosecute the trial without having the judge necessarily take over a government's function. As, for example, go for a moment to what went on during cross-examination of one of the witnesses, the court intervened where I was attempting to make a point about who received money. The court interrupted my cross-examination of that witness to raise the point as to who received drugs. Now, there was no misstatement of law involved there. There was no misstatement of fact. And the point that the judge made was the point that the government, if they choose to make, was perfectly capable of making, unless the judge is assuming at that point that the government is asleep at the switch and might overlook it. Now, in that connection, the judge intervened, we recited 13 times, 12 times in 3 days, and one time in the closing argument on the fourth day, concerning conduct of defense counsel. The judge never intervened concerning any government activity, although, for example, we apparently were asleep at the switch in pointing out the limited purpose of impeachment of witnesses called by the government when the government chooses to do so. Only very late in the trial did we ask for limiting instructions as to the impeachment testimony, and the judge never raised the issue, even though it was a point that the judge could have if the jury, if there's concern about the jury's being misled. So the judicial intervention was all one way, and it is submitted that the jury could only draw one inference from that, and that is a basic antagonism of the trial judge toward the defense position. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Daniels.
I have 3 minutes for three points, so I'd like to move on. Thank you, Your Honor. Specifically, the first point deals with the court being confused at sentencing as to whether or not my client's defense to the mandatory minimum under the statute. The court initially tried to give him the minimum and then changed its mind and said, oops, this is trumped by the guideline range. And it's our argument that he believed or had some belief that legally he couldn't give us the 240 months because of the fact that the guideline range was different. Well, of course, that's incorrect. And we believe this court has continuously not allowed judge to say you can't give a sentence if it's legal, and therefore he had the right to give that sentence. And he initially tried to do it and then was stopped from doing it. I think this court should reverse and remand to give him the opportunity to give him the 240, which he could have got.
Wasn't the guideline range 262?
Yes. That was the minimum, but he still could have given him the 240. Legally, he had the power to do it.
There were a valid ground for departure. What would be the valid ground for departure here?
Well, the judge in his argument said that he felt that was a the amount of time that he should have gotten. And I believe the Second District and other courts have ruled that pretty much any ground for departure that is not prohibited by the guideline range.
No, that's not the statutory test. Ground for departure has to be something that the Sentencing Commission has not given adequate attention to.
That's correct. But anything
what would that ground be in this case?
In this case, there are numerous reasons why he could downward depart. One, and I'm going to bring up on my second issue, deals with the downward departure of a co-defendant.
If we've already held that that's never a ground of downward departure, so is there any other ground?
Yes, the issue as to the fact that my client's role in the offense was potentially not as great as other defendants.
That's not something the commission has failed to give attention to. There are actually 2, 3, and 4 level reductions specified by the guidelines for limited role in the offense. It's not a ground for just saying, well, let's try 5 or 6. Right? It's something the commission has directly addressed and therefore isn't a ground for departure.
Well, at this stage in my brief, I requested a downward departure for numerous reasons, and at this stage it escaped me as to what my downward departure reasons were. But I continuously, numerous times requested on grounds that the commission didn't grant. Specifically, the second issue, which I think is as important, deals with the multiple conspiracy issue. In this case, it was clear that that should have been granted. The court says that there's discretion in allowing that. However, I believe that in this specific case, there was ample evidence of that. Right?
But your position is that he was not the sole deliverer, right?
That there were other individuals. In fact, he was in custody at times while this conspiracy was occurring.
But that doesn't negate the possibility of a conspiracy, though.
Right? No, but it does allow for the opportunity to have a multiple conspiracy issue presented to the jury, and specifically in regard to the issue that there was no specific evidence except for the evidence of snitches. There was no tape of my client. There was no specific delivery to an undercover agent. So it's not like a specific situation where we have them and we know we have them as part of this conspiracy.
Yes, I know your time has expired, but I just have one question, Mr. Daniels. You didn't respond to the government's position on waiver on this issue, did you?
No, I didn't.
Do you want to take a moment and do it now?
As far as the waiver, as far as the multiple conspiracy, we presented the multiple conspiracy to the jury and was rejected. I don't believe we waived it on the motion for. I don't know if it was on our motion for retrial, but I don't believe the issue was waived. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Daniels. Mr. Kelly?
morning, please the court. Kim Kelly. I represent Jerry E. McGinnis. At the outset, I will say that we will confess the government's position as to subsection B of the argument. I'll be addressing subsection A. In this conspiracy case of distribution of cocaine and heroin, as to my client, the critical witness was Heather Wise. She was the proverbial smoking gun. Prior to and relatively soon before, she had pled guilty in state court in Tazewell County to a felony theft charge. For purposes of sentencing, she also admitted the three other felonies that were charged. That was unlawful use of a credit card, unlawful possession of a controlled substance, and unlawful possession of a converted vehicle. We had marked those as exhibits and informed the government before day one of testimony. There was an argument at that point in time the government sought to limit for cross-examination purposes under 609A to just the conviction on the felony theft. We sought an expanded version because she had admitted these for purposes of sentencing. We also asked to reserve it, and on day two of the trial, the court did, under 608B, allow reference to the admission of unlawful use of a credit card based on the probative value of character, the witness's character for truthfulness. The argument here, though, is that we believe, and we are asking, I will acknowledge, for an expanded interpretation of 609A, that 609A should mean not just conviction in the strictest term, but also should allow the defendants to use these admitted, judicially admitted, three other felony cases, although they were not convicted. This court has said previously that Rule 609A can't mean what it says, meaning that we can't use the strictest of interpretation. And there are a number of cases in this and other courts that say, well, if there's a guilty verdict and we haven't rendered a conviction, or even a conviction the day prior to, without judgment, the day prior to the case where there could be post-trial motions, that's admissible. Conviction where there was an appeal pending would be permissible, or such as a conviction on a nolo contendere, or even a plea of convenience where the defendant denies the matters that he pled guilty to before. I think all the common denominator here is that we have the assurance that the defendant appeared before a judicial proceeding either acknowledging his or her responsibility or determination, there was a determination of culpability by a court. That's why we asked for the expanded patchwork to allow an admission before a judge of commission of felonies to be used for cross-examination purposes under 609A.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Mr. Murphy.
May it please the court and counsel. I'm Brad Murphy, an assistant U.S. attorney from Peoria, Illinois. Indeed, Judge McDade interrupted the final argument of Mr. Inman to correct his repeated misstatements about the government's burden of proof. We believe, however, that that only shows that Judge McDade was being vigilant, not belligerent, as the defense would have you believe. Mr. Inman openly agreed with Judge McDade's statement. He abandoned the argument and arguably has waived that issue for this appeal. The defense would also have you believe that cross-examination is unlimited. The district judge did find it necessary to interrupt counsel's presentation on a number of occasions. Now, if my math is correct, on three times he interrupted to clarify matters, three times to question the relevance of a line of questioning, three times to remind counsel that questions had been previously asked and answered, once to tell Mr. Daniels not to waste the court's time about inquiring about a drink of water, once to tell Mr. Inman that he did not need to read verbatim from a document already admitted into evidence, and once to try to find a time to break for lunch. Those are the 12 about which they complained.
How long did this trial take, Mr. Murphy?
Your Honor, it took the most of 4 days. My recollection is that we picked the jury on one day and had to start on a second day, so there was a short interruption, I believe, but almost 4 full days. Importantly, though, and indeed more importantly than the number of interruptions by the judge, is that at no time did Judge McDade comment on the veracity of any witness, nor did he become an advocate for either side. The defense has shown no prejudice whatsoever. I'll be happy to try to answer any questions about any other parts of the brief. Otherwise, my intentions are to forego the balance of my time and ask you to affirm these convictions.
Can I just ask one question, please, Mr. Murphy?
Yes,
with respect to the one defendant who received a rather lenient sentence, what was the legal basis for that?
It was the downward departure for the combination of age and infirmity, not when they were found in the combination that they are. He was, as I recall, 60...
Wasn't there a mandatory minimum?
Yes. And the judge departed below that as well.
What was the basis for that?
The basis for that downward departure for Mr. McGinnis was the combination of his age...
Why
is that
a basis for departure from a mandatory minimum?
My understanding that
if the departure looks totally illegal,
Your Honor, I can only say that on the basis of my observations of the defendant.
Yeah, but your observations of the defendant don't have anything to do with the application of a mandatory minimum sentence.
I did not find
the whole point. That's why it's called mandatory minimum.
I did not find Judge McDade's departure downward in this particular instance to be offensive.
We're kind of operating in a law-free zone here.
No, Your Honor, we're not. I acknowledge Judge McDade's authority to depart downward here based on the combination of...
such authority. Right, that's what I was asking. I think it's what my colleague was asking. The United States actually once went to the Supreme Court to have the Supreme Court address the question whether a district judge ever had the authority to depart below a mandatory minimum without a motion from the United States based on cooperation. And the Supreme Court held 9-0 that there is no such authority.
Are there any further questions?
You made no such motion here.
No.
All right, thank you, Mr. Murphy. And Mr. Inman?
Your Honor, I'll speak briefly to the issue that I have addressed earlier. I don't think my time is up yet, is it?
3 minutes. Well, apparently I misread. You had used your time, but you're here, and I will give you 2 minutes of rebuttal, even though your time is up.
Okay. I won't even use that 2 minutes, I think. I did want to address just a couple of points. Counsel suggested that I had agreed with the propriety of the judge's intervention or had waived the issue. I think examination of the record will indicate that I agreed with the judge's statement of law. I suggest that throughout the trial, counsel was put in an intolerable situation in order to resist the judge's interventions of having to, in front of the jury, get into arguments with the judge. I don't think any of us counsel appreciate being put in that situation in front of the jury any more than we appreciate having to raise the issue before this court. It's simply a mischaracterization that the court intervened, I think, to ensure a smooth flowing of the trial. The intervention was directed to the conduct of defense counsel. The trial, the actual evidence in the trial extended over 3 days. So there were 12 of these interventions in 3 days. The fourth day, or part of the fourth day, was spent on the closing argument when the 13th point occurred.
Just before you sit down, sir, is your position, you believe the law to be, unless each of the government's witnesses is believed beyond a reasonable doubt. Each one, is that a correct statement of law?
No, I don't think you have to, I don't think the argument has to be read as believing each individual beyond a reasonable doubt. The attempt in this context was to say that these witnesses have to be believed beyond a reasonable doubt.
You feel you were speaking to the totality of the evidence presented against your defendant?
Well, that's what I believe, and that certainly was my intent. I think it would be obviously wrong to say that each individual has to be believed, and if the judge had understood it that way, I think the judge, rather than sit there keeping a tally so he can pounce on counsel at the last moment before any corrections can be done, should intervene in a respectful and low-key way. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel. Mr. Inman, Mr. Dillon, Mr. Kelly, the court extends the thanks for accepting the appointments in this case. Case taken under advisement.